Hello and welcome to the End of Seeking podcast. We're at episode 25 and this is the first episode of the new year, 2024.
Yeah. What a start to the new year it's been.
Good God, yeah.
Feels like it sort of hit the ground running at a sprint is what it feels like to me.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the world's gone nuts, but no change there. And there's lots of things happening with you and with me.
Yeah.
Why don't you start with a few announcements just to get those out of the way?
Yeah.
Events and whatnot.
Actually, there's an event that starts today that's happening. Today is Wednesday. I don't know what date it is. The 17th. Mm-hmm. I'm part of an Enlightenment Summit where there's 12 speakers speaking on various modalities. My slot is 1 p.m. on Friday, and talking about energy work. And the replay of the videos is available until Monday, so it's free.
And that's for free.
It's totally free. So
jump on board and check it out.
Yeah, and I'll be in the chat. The idea is that the speakers and the participants of the summit will be able to converse, ask any questions, these kind of things. So I'll be on chat on Friday during around 1 p.m.
So the way that summit goes, there's a bunch of speakers speaking over the next,
3 days.
Right, so that's the summit, but that's part of a bigger program.
It is, yeah.
How long does it go on for?
From now until, I believe it's October or November even. Every month, two of those speakers, they'll be taking two different types of modalities and doing a workshop, a 90-minute workshop, right, and then another 90-minute questions and answer event. And so that is paid. Mm-hmm. And I'll be doing a workshop in July as part of the Holistic Enlightenment Month, mm-hmm, and then doing a Q&A a couple of weeks later. That's going to be interesting.
And other stuff that you're... That's the summit.
That's the summit. That's the next 3 days. And then I'm also doing my weekly schedule, which is Wednesdays, which obviously today is a Wednesday. Hopefully this will get out today, if not tomorrow.
Yeah.
Wednesdays I have a 30-minute Zoom meditation and transmission at 7 p.m. UK time, and on Sundays I do a satsang followed by a 1-hour transmission. The satsang starts at 4 p.m. The transmission starts at 5 p.m.
All UK time.
And then, gosh, it feels like I've got a lot of events coming up. There's going to be a month of light coming up, which I do this once a year. And it starts on the new moon on 9th of February and runs until the new moon on the 11th of March.
This just funny. I'm looking out the window here and just across the road, there's a guy with a workbench and an angle grinder. So if you hear any of that, please forgive him, for he knows not what he does. bless. Yes. Okay, sorry, so month of light.
Yeah, so a month of lights. And that's meeting daily. I find it's a nice touch point.
So there's going to be, you're going to do a transmission daily?
Daily, yeah.
It's for a whole month, a whole lunar month.
The butt end of winter.
Well, this is it, isn't it? Bring the light to the darkness,
yeah,
I say.
Yeah, and so on Sundays, there'll be a satsang before that at 7 p.m. And right, the transmission will be a longer transmission at 8 p.m. It'll be an hour long, and it will be not only a divine light transmission, but also healing energies. Nice. I'll bring sort of, which is the way I see that, is a slightly different frequency, slightly different.
Weaving a different frequency in there. Yeah.
Different energy footprint. So that will be on Sundays. So yeah, every day for a month, if you want to join me for that, you're very welcome.
So I've got something coming up as well. It's going to be in March. I mean, this is the first time I'm doing a public group for several years now.
Yeah.
So that's going to be fun. I'm going to... I've yet to completely figure out the complete details of it, but more or less, it's going to be Saturdays in March, 3 p.m. UK time. It's going to be generally a satsang with a divine light transmission. That's the core of it. But each week I'm going to be doing, I'm going to be weaving in a bit of a theme on spiritual foundations. So things like each week I'll be pick something like meditation, self-inquiry, prayer, mm-hmm. Thusness, transmission. And each week it's going to be a satsang, so there'll be Q&A and discussion. There'll be an opportunity. It'll be try to keep it experiential so people can really, you know, I'll probably do a guided meditation at least most weeks so people will settle into their own nature and then we can explore the awakening path and our true nature through these sort of foundational lenses. So that's the idea. So there'll be I'll put details on my website and I'll mention it when that's completely secure in the calendar. But Saturday's in March, save the date.
Yeah, and we've been having lots of discussions about it, and I'm very excited to see what comes of this, actually.
Yeah, it's been ages since I've actually gone public. But life, it's funny how it goes. I mean, I've been sort of in a condition of withdrawal for several years. Yeah. I mean, I've been doing, you know, one-on-one sessions here and there. But really, the energy went very much withdrawn. And I've, you know, been exploring true nature, my nature, you know, through a lot of writing. Contemplative writing became something that was really important. But now I feel life is going, nope, get out, you know, go.
Kicking you out of the nest.
Yeah. It's funny. It's like, you're right, that bit's done.
Yeah. I get the image of the hermit opening the door of his hermitage and going, emerging, oh, there's a world out there.
Blinking into the light, going, what's out here? So that's where I'm going. So anyway, I'll let you know more about that.
Watch
the space. But, okay.
Yeah. We don't have a plan today, particularly.
Do we ever? We do sometimes.
We do sometimes, yeah.
There's two things I could think of that we could touch on. One of them we talked about doing, which you had brought up and someone else had confirmed it and go, yeah, I'd like to see that, which we talk a little bit about silence.
Yep. I think the last podcast we sort of vaguely promised it. So,
right.
Yeah, there's that.
And another thing was we just touched on this morning was bliss, which we kind of ran off on a, you know, opened that up in conversation between us. So that's got some juice. So,
yeah.
What's your feeling?
choices.
They're both intimately related.
Well, that was literally what I was about to say, actually. It's like, actually, you pull on the thread of either of those, and I feel you get to the other one. And my sense is to go with silence to start with.
Well, it's funny. Yeah. You know, we were talking about doing silence as a theme the other day, and the thought that came to me was, the experience of silence is bliss.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, that's such a... Yeah. We can talk about this from a really experiential point of view.
Because for most people, or if you said that to most people, they would be like, what? What are you on about? Right. Silence is not bliss. Silence for me is awkward. Silence, lot of people have a very difficult relationship with silence, actually.
Well, what was that quote? I can't remember who it was. A great philosopher says, you know, that all the problems of the world come down to the fact that most people can't sit quietly in a room on their own.
Yeah.
In silence.
And I see that again and again. And it's funny because, you know, obviously I have a lot of exposure to meditators who purposefully culture and cultivate their relationship with silence and meditation. And so I get exposed to a lot of people who are by most measures quite comfortable with silence, let's say, and yet still they struggle with silence.
But I, you know, we talked about this. I think we know people. I know people. Everyone knows people. Maybe you're one of those people who, oh my God, God forbid I should have to sit in silence. So people stay busy a lot. And it seems as though it's the silence that's the problem. You know, they sit in quietly in a room and the silence is the problem, but it's not. It's what comes rushing in when we start busying ourselves. That's what causes our trouble. Because the silence itself, when you drop into that experiential, non-conceptual silence, it in itself, if you allow it, if you let that silence... Sorry, I just hit my mic stand. If you allow that silence to be and identify it and remain there as that.
And sink wholly into it.
It becomes very blissful. It or does indeed. At least peaceful.
Yeah. But
quiet.
Often there's a charming pull into the silence but the thing is you have to traverse, and this is what you're talking about there. You often have to traverse quite a lot of gunk at the top end of that, of all the things that you've been avoiding meeting.
Yeah.
And so this is where people mostly stop at that, which is they sit in silence and all they see is actually it gets noisier. It gets more things happening.
Yeah.
It's because there's not sufficient attention being given to the inner workings of life. And so when you do sort of traverse through those experiences, it does bottom out into this silence, and this silence itself is full. It's got this aliveness, this bliss, and this is what we ended up talking about this morning off the back of a really beautiful session that I had with someone about this topic.
Yeah. Where's the bliss?
Yeah.
It's all bliss.
It's all bliss.
The nature of being is bliss. I came to that's my position on it, is that the whole thing is made of bliss. It's as fundamental to reality as consciousness, as is being itself. And in the Hindu tradition, it's Satchitananda. It's the nature of the self. It's the nature of being itself. Being, existence, consciousness, and bliss. And bliss is kind of left out.
Just for those that aren't familiar with that, to break it down, sat is being.
Yeah, sat is being or existence. Chitta is consciousness, awareness. Bliss is, ananda is bliss, or Satchitananda is the sort of the irreducible nature of being. And I actually think that's right on the money, experientially. So it's not just that bliss is a function of is like an emanation or a relative aspect. It is actually the very fabric of being. Mm-hmm. What stops us from experiencing it as such?
Mm-hmm.
Expectations, yes. Judgments. So if you have like the expectations, as you pointed out, people go, "Where's the bliss?" What they're saying is, "Where's the ecstasy?" Right?
Yeah.
That's the expectation. They're mistaking
bliss for a heightened version of bliss. It still is bliss, but it's this heightened, ecstatic, loud, experiential bliss. Yes. It's a bliss that is coming and going in its experience in terms of the quality of it.
Yeah. But in fact, drop the judgments, drop the expectations, and again, drop into their silence of being.
Mm-hmm.
We notice, there's a quiet, uncaused joy about this. It is the very nature of that is, we talked about the nature of love as being fundamental too, and I arguably you could say something like love is bliss in action.
Yeah, or exactly. Some bliss in movement. It's a fragrance or an aspect of bliss that is very intimate with all of us, and that is love.
So, but once the judgments and expectations have been, as you say, traversed or transcended, and the experience of silence in one's own nature, as one's own nature, is found to be also blissful, now it can be very quiet.
Yeah.
It can be a very quiet experience. But just the ground itself is not neutral.
No, and it's not nothing. It's not devoid. It's not empty.
It's this aliveness.
Yeah, fullness. It's like the fullness of the potentiality of life is pregnant in that silence, in that stillness.
It's vibrating in its own nature.
Exactly,
isn't it?
And that's why I would use the word aliveness there. We talked about this in our conversation of bliss being so misunderstood that often I substitute the word bliss for aliveness because it's so misunderstood. But as you rightly pointed out, there's so much that's missed then in that aliveness because it can, that aliveness can feel a little bit cold somehow. Yeah. Devoid of the causeless joy, the contentment, the goodness, the love, the all of these
that's
words
inherent in the very nature of our being,
and that is bliss. And the nature of our being is that bliss. It's just it doesn't look like an experience. It is the very ground is made of that, and every experience is made of that. You know, the conversation I was having in that session earlier today was, you know, coming, you know, it came up in conversation, this idea of pain. And I think, I'm not sure if it's come up in podcast before, but certainly you and I have talked at length about this. And I've talked in my satsangs a lot about this, of where pain, you know, to me is the lack of sinking into the experience. The pain is the surface level experience. And as you sink into it, that pain starts to transmute and transform and actually does bottom out in bliss.
And it's about, we have talked about this before, it's about stepping out of the descriptions of the experience we're having and into the experience itself.
Yeah.
In a non conceptual way. You step out of the discursive, descriptive, judgmental mind into the direct experience, and then and we talk about pain. It's a great one, and it's a very challenging one. I'm not saying it comes easily necessarily, in a sense, because of the intensity of that.
Yeah, it's very intense. In the same way, ecstatic experiences are very intense and can be painful in their ecstasy as well.
Right. And in fact, I was reading about Teresa of Avila, who a great, you know, mystic of the Middle Ages, and she would fall into these mystic ecstasies, and you know, it was dangerous at that time because they were burning a lot of heretics at that time. So some people might, and I think some people did sort of go, "It's of the devil," kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I think she had the support of. Various, you know, priests and stuff who said, no, she's, you know, this is genuine stuff. But she found it to be really bodily difficult.
Yeah.
And she would pray, "Can you just, Lord, thank you for these ecstasies, for these," but it would take it out of her, and she got ill.
Is this overwhelming?
Because physically it had a kind of an overwhelming thing to it.
I mean, this is where our conversation of bliss kind of went as well earlier today, where you were talking about your own experience with that.
Yeah.
And how sometimes that can be a very intense and overwhelming experience.
And this actually is an interesting interesting observation, because often, you know, if you're what you get a lot in spiritual seekers is this desire for that bliss, that heightened bliss. Okay, oh, where's the bliss? I want that, and the idea. You know, it's sort of spiritual experience seeking.
Yeah.
So the idea that I want to be in bliss all the time, I want to be in this ecstasy all the time. But then if you had that 24/7, you wouldn't be able to function, right? If you had it as you conceive of it, which is super high peak experience all the time, you just burn out. And this is the power of the low ground. This is the power of the everyday experience of awakening.
Mm-hmm.
Can have these still have these peaks and these troughs, let's say, but it's the quiet bliss, the uncaused joy, the ever present okayness, goodness, subtle. In every experience, in doing the dishes, in going for a walk, in shopping,
it's true peace, but it's not peace in terms of the environment, it's peace in terms of the heart. And to me, this speaks to silence again. It's like silence doesn't mean no talking. Silence is a silence of the heart, is a rest in the heart where the silence of being is found. And to me, it's like that thing of to sink into the heart is to find the silent contentment of being.
Mm.
And that is really precious when you find yourself orientated towards that and living from that place. You're That's living it. In silence, and yet you're still going about your day and doing your job and interacting yeah. with people. But you yourself are seated in the silence
you
of the heart.
You never lose that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
and
beautiful.
So silence is not about not talking or not listening to music or not having a conversation with a good friend. It's not, silence is not on that level to me. That is a very superficial version of silence.
Well, it's
concept
a
concept of silence.
Really. Right. Sorry. It's a kind of a gateway, isn't it? So if you're, as most are, lost in the discursive mind. That's it. That's mm-hmm. all we know. We don't have access to that side. We don't recognize that silence as ubiquitous. We don't recognize that silence is the very ground of our being. And so one starts off doing something like meditation, where you may get an introduction into that gap. Yeah. Oh, you drop into the silence for a moment, a glimpse of it. And in that silence...
Yeah, the whole system, the body, everything sort of goes...
And then the mind comes up again. So it becomes, we've talked about this before, how in dualistic seeking, let's say, there's a binary, there's an in and out. You've discovered the silence, the gap.
Mm-hmm.
But then, and that could become a form of meditation where you go to that, where you learn to culture that, where you settle into
that. But it's still
that.
Binary of either I'm there or I'm not.
Exactly. But after a while, and this is the abiding nature, you recognize, oh, that ground, that silence, that blissful, boundless being is always available. And all the thoughts then.
Is the depths of who I am.
And I remember we talked years ago, I think, it kind of blew your mind in the same way as it blew my mind. We talked about the nature of no mind.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you can have no mind and you can still have thoughts.
Yeah, I really struggled with that post-awakening, actually. Like, so there was a time where immediately after that shift of awareness, that shift of consciousness that recognized who and what I am, everything was very quiet for a couple of months. And then suddenly thoughts came back with a vengeance. And I was like, what the hell's going on? Like, really freaked me out. Like, really.
Because you had expectations.
Yeah, I thought I'd lost something that I had. Like, and it really did. I remember there was a couple of days there where it really shook me. And I really felt unsteady on my feet because I was like, whoa, what's going on here? That's not what was supposed to happen. And I because I'd had what you were speaking of there, like this concept, this idea that it was synonymous, no thoughts and no mind were synonymous.
Yes.
And then suddenly there was thoughts, but I didn't recognize that there was still no mind. It was just that there was thoughts there.
Yeah. It's like a layer. It's like a higher version of it. Because right, as a spiritual practitioner, as a spiritual seeker, where the abidance hasn't arrived yet, you are in and out, and really, no mind does mean no thoughts.
Yeah,
and so it's meditation, it's something like that, or self inquiry, or something that allows you to mirror back, drop into your own quiet heart. But as we say, it's an in and out thing. But once that's abidance. That no-mindness, that quiet, that silence is the very ground, and it can fill up.
Yeah.
And it's always going to be empty and silent.
There can be content,
All the content, all the sensations, all the feelings and thoughts, all that stuff.
All held within the deeper context and container of the silence of being. The self.
Yeah.
Yeah, that really freaked me out. I mean, we're going
so
back
how
quite
did
a
that
number
resolve,
of years now.
How did it resolve itself?
I think it was a conversation you and I had, and it was also a conversation I had with a teacher at the time, and that reassured me and pointed out that actually, no, there was still no mind. It's just that there were thoughts there as well. And that resolved that.
Yeah, because you went, oh of course.
That minor freak out, yes.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, waking up is it takes a while to get used to it. Even though it's established, even though the ground is fully established, that somehow your layers of intelligence and whatnot are still sort of, you know, figuring out, oh, what's this, what's that, what's the implication of that, the downstream implications of what it is now to be living in a...
Oh, that can take years.
Yeah.
I really hold to the view. I'm not saying that's the case for everyone, but I really do feel it can take a long time to integrate all of this and to break apart leftover vestiges of views and expectations and concepts and beliefs that says awakening looks like this. And if that is showing up in your experience, there's something wrong in your experience. Yeah. I mean, I encounter it all day, every day with the people I meet with. It's like so much of the difficulties in all of this is around expectations and learnt beliefs and ideas of how it should look.
Yeah. Particularly post-awakening.
Particularly post-awakening, yeah.
It's like Ken Wilber talks about, you know, these stages where you go, you grow up, you wake up, and then clean up. And that's part of it. There's going to be this cleanup that happens once you've woken up.
Which is different. We're going into a slightly different subject here, but it is different than... We were talking about this quite a few weeks ago now. I can't recall exactly, but there's subtle differences between the sort of detoxification of ideas and the growing embodiment. So there's a detoxification / integration, let's call it. And then there's a growing embodiment that happens as well. And they are very much linked and sometimes hard to distinguish, and you don't need to distinguish. But there is this growing embodiment, and to me it's like, and I use this, I know I've used this word, and it's maybe not technically the right word, but I use it in a very particular way, and that is self-actualization.
Right.
And I know psychologically speaking there's an idea of self-actualization, and I don't mean it in those terms. I just mean it in like to actualize the full potential of this expression of consciousness. And I mean that in the human sense of in this body, in this way, that full expression grows and develops and blooms.
I was going to say it's like a blossoming of potentials.
Exactly.
So there's I would say at least two movements, as you were just saying. The one is that like a kind of a cleanup of maybe shadows and conditionings and traumas, those kind of embodiments that need to be sort of purified out of the system.
Exactly. And then
there's this another one, which is a sort of a refinement and a blossoming of potentials.
Yeah, exactly. They might not be a distinct line between the two of those, and they work hand in hand together, and you know they're simultaneous in their development, let's say. And also it can be somewhat pre-awakening there is a description of somewhat of that happening anyway. But it takes on a new form post-awakening because the ground has been discovered. And so therefore, in that ground, the ability to meet is now...
The ego's not pushing against it in the same way.
Exactly. It's not working against all of that.
Yeah.
It's because the ego is that protection mechanism, those coping mechanisms by which... safety is found in the system. But when that deeper ground opens up, there's where the new safety is seated.
Right.
And it's not a human type safety, yet it includes the human safety, but it's a deeper kind of safety. It's a deeper sort of stability or sense of groundedness in being.
The groundless ground, isn't it?
Exactly.
And that's the thing that the ground is not... I think I tweeted once about modern science as it relates to, as it kind of parallels, you know, spiritual insight, in that as science has gone searching for more and more deeper and deeper fundamental bedrock, the fundamental building blocks of reality, the further and the deeper it's gone, the less corporeal, the less material it's become. And so at the bottom of it, it's just a field of emptiness, a field of like a fluctuating emptiness.
Yeah.
And that's the inner experience. And so, you know, trying to, the ego takes its security, such as it is, from stable phenomena, seemingly, but no phenomena is stable, so it'll always be vulnerable.
Yeah, which is why it makes so much of an effort to try and shore up its boundaries, yeah, because it feels its inherent vulnerability, yeah, and lack of stability. Yeah. It's poor foundation, basically.
And so the irony is that the true ground is found to be groundlessness.
Yes, that free fall is that sense of free fall, and yet in that free fall there is a continuity, there is a sense of groundless ground, this deep sense of unendingness.
Yeah, ever falling into the mystery.
Yeah,
rather beautiful, really.
Yes,
but you know, jumping into jumping into that free fall.
Yeah, it's challenging for if there's any leftover vestiges of the ego.
Absolutely. And they'll get cleaned up. That's, yes, the thing. But it's then they'll get mopped up after, yeah, as a function of consciousness itself, not as a function of individual striving. Although I guess it can look like that sometimes.
It plays out through the individual doing, yeah, the work.
But there's a deeper witness to that.
Exactly. And that's what's known with awakening. It's, yeah, the recognition, the conscious aha,
yeah,
of the recognition of that deeper witness, for want of a better word.
Yeah. So silence is
juicy.
Silence is juicy, and silence is the ground. And I always like Nisargadatta Maharaj's talk about how the difference between duality and non-duality, or ignorance and awakened, is that prescriptions in duality or instructions, let's say, or comments that are taken as prescriptions by an ego, are revealed to be simply descriptions to the awakened mind.
Yeah, I find this to be very, rest
is awareness,
true,
for example, is a great example of that. To a seeker, that's an instruction. To awaken, that's what I am. Yeah. I am ever resting
that
as awareness.
That is a description of what is.
And so you see that when you're as someone's approaching non-duality, approaching awakening, is that, you know, one's conversation or one's work, you know, dialogue with them, you find that more and more, like, it's funny how this works in teaching, in spiritual teaching or guidance, is that you can only what comes out is what's needed and what can be heard.
What's being drawn out.
What's,
yeah,
being drawn out. And so I find myself when I'm with someone and they're very much approaching, let's say, mm-hmm, that abiding insight, is that much more of my language becomes impersonal, much more my language becomes, yeah, descriptive,
and more about
less
being,
about you do that, yeah, and more about this is how it is.
And things like the because word notice growing insight starts to come, the words like notice.
Yes, exactly.
I've noticed this a lot. It's like the instructive tone of this is what you need to do, and the questions surrounding what should I do, they start to fall away, and it becomes a exploration of noticing what is.
Right, because that's all awakening is. It's about this deep. I say all because it's a pretty profound thing. But it's truth. It's the recognition of reality as it is.
It's clarity, clear clarity, seeing, yeah, of the nature of reality as it is, and the lived experience of that. It's, yes, not a concept anymore. No. It's a lived, somatic, lived experience.
Yeah, a living recognition of,
yeah,
the nature
beyond
of
all
what
concepts.
Is. Yeah.
You could say not a single word about it and yet know the fullness of what is.
Well, this is it, isn't it? You start talking about it and, you know, you're always going to fall a bit shorter.
Yes.
Somewhat, but you have a go. And that's why I love that. So for many years I was a meditator. That was my path. And although I study was also part of that, but it was mostly meditation and sort of spiritual study, let's say, spiritual knowledge. And then when I started to step into more satsang and self-inquiry and the direct approach, the idea of pointings, mm-hmm. this idea of pointing, came. And it's distinct from sort of a studied knowledge because it like a non-dual or a spiritual pointing performs a function which is to point to a reality rather than merely describe it. It's experiential. You know, this is why satsang is so powerful. It can be so powerful because it's not about anything. It's intended to mirror the questioner back to their own experience. Lived experience.
Yeah, it becomes breadcrumbs.
What's the source of that question? Mm-hmm. What's the source? Who's the one who asks the question?
Yeah.
And so pointings become very important. And so pointing is not so much a description or analysis as a method.
Yeah.
To return the practitioner back to their own, the recognition and the attention on their own.
This is why to me, everything that I say or any other teacher says or any other teaching should always be used as a jumping off point to take a look at your own experience of what they speak of from your own experience. And actually it reminds me of, we had this conversation, I don't know, the days merge into one another. But within the last week, we've had this discussion about Lecto Divina. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you'd probably be better at describing the technical description of that, but this idea of using spiritual texts to really sink into them, to not try and read them for their knowledge, but actually for what they're pulling you into.
And
I know that's something that's very present in your
daily life. Funny enough, I was using what in the Christian tradition, mystic Christian tradition, or the contemplative Christian tradition, is lectio. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it properly. Lectio Divina, or Divina, means something like sacred reading.
Mm.
Right, and you're right on the money. It's in itself a method. It's part of a whole. I think there's a four stage thing that the contemplative Christians would use. You know, reading a scripture or a text or something on different levels, and that was one of them. Or maybe it's that one contains four different modes. Mm-hmm. But I was sort of doing this generally because. For a long time, and maybe a lot of people can identify with this. So if you're engaged on the spiritual path, if that, and you are reading, you know, different spiritual texts or the commentaries of spiritual teachers or whatever it is, and you might be reading or even great literature, actually.
Poetry. Exactly. Is really beautiful for that.
Right. And so you sit there and you're reading and you'll hit, like you'd be reading, going along, and you're open about it. You've got a kind of open contemplative mood about you.
You're feeling the words more than thinking about them and trying to understand them and analyze them. You're feeling them.
Yes, exactly. And then what I was finding was that I'll get to something, one line, and boom, and I'll feel like an elevation of my sense of being or something, and it would pull me into out of the reading and into this blissful silence. And that had a gravity, and so the reading was just a jumping off point, and I would just read innocently, and then sooner or later something would touch me and I would go into a sort of a spiritual sort of contemplative reverie.
And I think most people resist that. And right. they think, oh, no, I've got to...
Got to get back to the book. Yeah, but that's what the book's for.
Yes, exactly. And it's funny, you know, we mentioned this because actually I've got a book that I'm hoping to publish myself. Right, yeah. And it's of poetry that is with that in mind.
Right.
Is with, like, if someone only reads a couple of words and it's they feel the transmission of that that's pulling them into... the depths of their being. That's the whole point of the book for me.
Yeah, you put it down at that point if you want, you know, but you use the text as a jumping off point for your own contemplative introspection, revelry. Meditation, reverie, mood.
Yeah.
That just allow it to do it. Yeah. Don't worry about it.
To allow yourself to fall in love with yourself and the love with the silence and the bliss of being through the words. Mm.
And also, you know, great insight can come from that as well. Yeah. And that's the other aspect of that. You can fall into that reverie of silence, drop into the, you know, the experience of, you know, consciousness, bliss, being. Mm. But then, you know, ideas can emerge from that. New wisdom, new thoughts, new insight can actually manifest as well from that. So it's this beautiful mechanism.
Yes. Yeah, it's the difference between, you know, I see sometimes people trying to strive to gain wisdom and clarity.
Yes.
And actually, my recommendation to people is always drop into the silence. Let wisdom come upon you through the mist. Yeah. Let it be drawn up into you from the depths and into the clarity, the light of awareness. This, to me, is where true wisdom comes from. Is an inner to the outer rather than the other way around, trying to find it in the outer and trying to draw it into
and
the inner.
And analyze it and conclude. Yeah. And
so rest in being, rest in the silence of the heart. And this is where I think true wisdom will be discovered.
Well, I always felt, and I'm sort of with Nisargadatta on this, that... So his experience was he had a master. I couldn't pronounce his name at this point. I can't remember exactly, something like Siddhaswar. Anyway, but he was a great master, a living, you know, embodiment of you know, reality. But Maharaj Nisargadatta would say in my master instructed me to sit in the I am, which is to say sit in the sense of I am-ness, you know, your sense of existence. Just identify that, sit with that. And he said for about 3 years, every waking spare moment, I would just sit in the I am.
Yeah, it's a powerful technique.
And that's, by his account, that's all he did. Yeah. And within 3 years, he'd realize the self. Yeah. Now, why is that so potent? Because you're sitting in the silence there. But I was thinking about this from, let's look at it through, imagine you're a scientist and you're in a laboratory and you're trying to figure out what's going on with this thing. So you've set up your experiment and you need to observe carefully. And the more quietly, more subtle, most tenderly you can watch and observe what's going on, then you're going to discover what's true. Mm-hmm. But if you're chatting away, if your mind's and you're not, and the quality of your observation is poor, then you're not going to see the nature of the reality that you're trying to observe. And so what's interesting, what's really beautiful about the spiritual path and the spiritual process and things like meditation, self-inquiry, is that you are, in order to discern and recognize the nature of reality, you become quiet, you become quiet, you become quiet. And so your observation, your just ambient observation becomes unintruded by ideas, concepts, judgments, all that. But what's interesting is that the very thing you're observing is the awareness. It's awareness knowing itself.
Yeah, self-referral.
So exactly. The observer knowing the observer, watching the observer observing. And so just simply by keeping quiet, this is what Papaji used to say, you know, keep quiet.
Yeah.
That's it. And you begin then to discern the nature of reality. You begin to discern that this is a singular wholeness. You begin to discern that there's no individual self here. You begin to discern that this is oneness and that this is all the nature of consciousness, and all that's revealed by keeping quiet, by abiding, resting in silence, resting as that awareness, by being, becoming the witness, the observer. Mm-hmm. And that's the principle.
Beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so simple, really, isn't it?
The mind wants to make it all so complicated. How many times have I heard, and I've heard it from my own lips as well, could it be this simple? Surely it's not this simple.
And often that's when someone is actually breaking through.
Yeah.
And suddenly the ubiquity of their awareness is recognized.
Yeah.
Here, oh.
And then you start to see the cosmic joke of it all.
Yes. Yes.
The dog chasing its own tail for all this time. The ego chasing its own tail. Yeah. It is so simple. But it doesn't mean it's easy. It's very, very simple, but it's so hard because of all the impressions and concepts and ideas and conditioned views that occlude us from seeing the simplicity of it all.
And something that's really become much more evident to me, and I'm sure it's been evident to you for a long time, is the somatic nature of this.
Yeah.
That, like, it's all very well and good to be a sort of a non-dualist and say, hey, just drop this thought, drop that thought, drop that. It's all very well and good to be that dismissive, and I know some are. But the fact is, these thoughts, these occluding thoughts, these concepts, or in Buddhism we call them those false notions, are embodied.
Yeah.
You know, they're felt realities. And so it is correct to see through the thoughts.
Yes.
But you have to contend with the energetic correlate of that in the body. And so, and dissolving what does that concept, believed and held deeply and conditioned, it's felt in the body. So even if you're not thinking that thought in particular at a particular time, the impression is in the body.
Yeah, and this is why people who have very clear insight in the thoughts get very frustrated, because they're still having the same reactivity, even though they don't believe the thought, even though they see through the thought. I've come across time and time again, and again in my own experience, I've seen this as well, whereby there is clear insight, there's clear understanding, clear intellectual knowledge, there's clear insight, real true insight into the nature of that thought, and that it's not real, it's not true. Yet, because there hasn't yet been a full submersion into the somatic experience of that, the energetic felt lived reality of that thought, it's like it's on the surface level, it's uprooted, but it hasn't been uprooted from the depths.
Yeah.
And so this is why I'm constantly encouraging people to not only address things on the thought level. It's not to reject the thought level, but it's to use the thought level as the mode of transport, let's say, to the deeper somatic, embodied, energetic, felt experience. You know, there's so many dimensions of experiencing that we can encounter. And to try and solve it just on the thought level is actually forgetting that so much of our experience is not just thought-based.
Yeah, we're energetic beings.
Yeah.
There's a felt sense that needs to be acknowledged, recognized, integrated.
Yeah, met.
Met. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's why you can still have very, very clear ideas that have been uprooted and yet still have an experience that keeps repeating itself. And you can even have an empty mind, so to speak, a quiet, no thoughts, and still have an experience that, should you use a thought to describe it, it's still the experience that you know is not.
Yeah, it's no point just trying to shut the mind up forever and ever. No. You do have to, as you say, sort of uproot these things. And it is through the power of awareness, ultimately. Mm-hmm. But awareness isn't just this sort of cognitive space.
Not at all.
It's a felt sense as well. That's
awareness traverses all manner of experiences. Yeah, and contains all experience. Yeah.
And I think a lot of people are not sufficiently, you know, in their spiritual seeking and in their spiritual, you know, path, and are not sufficiently, or let me put it a different way, would benefit greatly from integrating and dropping into the felt sense more fully.
Yeah, I think for too long we have been tuned to and therefore value the conceptual realm.
Yeah.
And to solely. often to the detriment of even recognizing that there are other experiences, other parts of experience. Yes. And so because we're so heavily orientated towards, that was the word I was after before, orientated towards the conceptual realm, it can actually, it's like learning a new language that that people, you know, when you introduce them, well, what are you feeling when that thought is happening? Yeah. They go, what?
Yeah.
A real alien sort of.
Oh, no, and I identify that myself for so long.
And so I think that's the missing piece in
awakening,
the detox, the purifications part of awakening is that you can uproot the thought of it, but if you haven't traversed into the different layers of the experience fully, it's still going to be there. So you're still going to be, you know, for instance, the I thought, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you go at that just on a thought level, but what about the felt experience of the I? And so people can do self-inquiry on the mind level of who am I for a long time and miss the fact that there's still a belief, even though on a mind level, you see that I'm not an I, I'm not a person, I'm not an ego, but
there's still a sense of it.
There's still a feeling that you are. And I encounter this all the time. People really frustrated about the fact that they clearly see there's no doer. They clearly see that they're not a person. They clearly see that they're awareness, and yet they act in life as if they are. And there's the trouble. And so there's a frustration there. And it's because it hasn't been investigated, inquired into on a felt somatic level, just on the thought level.
Well, this is, you know, the great power of teaching such as Nisargadatta's I am. Mm-hmm. Drop into the sense I am. That's what he's saying.
He's
not saying drop into the thought I am. Yeah. Drop into the sense of, identify the sense of that. And you stay there long enough and it becomes quite clear then that the I that's being talked about, that corresponds to that, isn't what you thought it was.
No, it's a false I. The I that is being identified as I is actually a false I.
Right.
The true I is that sense of existence.
So dropping into that, the I am-ness there, the sense of the I, and same with Ramana Maharshi, who am I? Or whence am I? Whence did this thought come? Who am I? You drop into okay, what does that I that I'm that conceptually I'm asserting or affirming, go and see, well, what does that point to? What is that word? What's that about? And then you spend enough time there and you realize and that's it. The dawning realization is, oh, this I isn't an I as such. It's a sense of being, which eventually dawns to be being itself.
And that being boundless and not bound by the body, not bound by the mind.
Exactly. And so by dropping into the I am or the who am I, by dropping into the reality of it, the silent non-conceptual reality, that you discover the reality of that, and the thought, which is to say the I thought, then just dissolves. And you know that now, that I thought doesn't point to an actual individual entity that isn't a self or a person or an I.
And so if it shows up again, it's seen for what it is. It's seen for the thought that it is and the false belief that is. And it's also seen what is actually truly pointed to.
because you haven't taken it at its word, you've discovered whence it comes. What is this? I say I, but what do I mean? What's the I that this relates to?
Exactly.
And then you spend time there and you discover it to be true. And that's why I think these practices are so foundational.
Yeah.
And you know, these aren't complicated approaches to discerning and realizing reality. You do have to drop into the experience and out of the mind.
Which is very hard for most people when they've been perpetually trained. It's drummed into us.
There's only mind to most people.
Well, you look at the whole schooling system. It's just absolutely catered to and puts extreme value on...
Well, it's left brain, isn't
it? Yeah, exactly. The mind, the ego as being who and what you are.
Yeah. It's, what do they say? Particle thinking, not wave thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, because the science would say, you know, on a quantum level, reality is a wave function. Mm-hmm. And then at the point of observation, it becomes a particle. But it's not really a particle. Still, it's still a functional wave. But the wave, in a sense, represents the sort of the wholeness, the boundless, connected, open oneness of it all. And then the particle is this discrete part of it. But you look close enough at the discrete part of it, and you realize, oh, it's just indistinguishable from the boundless wave function.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All of this from the subject of silence.
Well, you know, it's the alpha and the omega. You know, you drop the silence is the first prescription and the final realization.
Yeah, it is. I love that. That's a really, there you go. That's a good tweet.
Yeah.
So true. The first point of stepping into this arena.
I truly believe that true spirituality begins at that first glimpse of silence. The way I think of it is the gap.
Yeah, whether you conceptually understand it as silence or not, but it's that glimpse, it's that first parting of the clouds, the first recognition of, oh, there's a sky beyond all these clouds, all these thoughts.
It changes everything forever.
It does.
Because that can only, everything else then becomes, even though you might get completely lost in phenomena again, your embodied intelligence, your own consciousness knows now.
Yeah, the taste
this
of that.
This, because it's bliss. Yeah. It is bliss. You know, that moment of gap, it's,
those peace, people it's bliss. That it's, have had these spiritual mystical experiences, and they put a lot of weight on the experience itself rather than what was being pointed to in the experience. And that's why they felt this sense of calmness, this sense of peace, this sense of a love of life, this sense of oneness with life. All of these things were fragrances or effects of recognizing the self.
But it's, as you say, that it's misappropriated. So, you know, people have non-conceptual experiences all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You listening to music, for one, is a great thing. You know, you're not thinking, oh, that's a great bit. Oh, I like that note. Oh, this. When we listen to music, good music that takes us, that carries us,
mm-hmm.
the mind goes quiet and we're carried on this blissful sort of ride.
Or if we're in nature.
Right, if we're in nature,
stunning. Yeah.
Suddenly you're struck dumb and you're looking at this masterpiece in the sky and not thinking. But the trouble, and certainly flow experiences are like this, but as it's conceived of, this is my thought on it, and we might have spoken about this before, this is where these ideas of flow as it's commonly understood is misguided, because the experience of flow is spontaneous, like this sort of intersection between intention and surrender. It's you lose your self-consciousness and it becomes high functioning and very enjoyable and very blissful. So the experience of flow, whether you're a rock climber or whether you're a guitarist or whatever it is.
You lose the personal self.
Right. But the attention, the trouble is the intention. Although the mind goes quiet, the attention is still with only the phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
And what the important thing is in the difference between sort of the experience of that flow and what we're talking about is dropping into no mind is the acknowledgement mm-hmm. and the awareness of awareness.
Yeah, the spotlight turns on rather subject. From the object, it turns to the subject.
Yeah. And so in a sense, flow is a good signpost, but it's a missed opportunity because it doesn't effectively turn the mind back in on itself.
And that's the same with, I would say, with psychedelic experiences, you know.
Right.
Attention is again on the object, the fantastical experiences that maybe open up the mind to a different reality. Yet
and they it can don't, be boundary breaking, to be
absolutely,
fair.
Absolutely, absolutely. But it doesn't actually turn the spotlight very effectively back onto the subject who is the one that is experiencing this.
It's not what you know, but who's doing the knowing exactly. or what's doing the knowing.
Exactly. And so that's where it's not very effective in terms of actual true awakening. Yeah.
But it in a sense it's a glimpse of no mind of a sort. Yeah. So it's a move in the right direction, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a massive advocate for it just because of the pitfalls of things like psychoactive.
I wouldn't recommend it necessarily.
No, it can be really detrimental for the system. But it can provide a real genuine glimpse as well.
Yeah, no doubt. And you know, this is very much, you know, these things are part of a shamanic tradition. But, you know, to be honest, most people in the West, I don't know. It's a bit like meditation, though, when I see it. And, you know, when meditation and spiritual practice gets, let's say, secularized, it loses its value. Hmm?
And commercialized as
well. And commercialized, exactly. That's the next step. But, you know, it loses its value and it loses its core intention. And I would argue it loses its power because, you know, connected and to its origins in these mystical experiences, and that become then spiritual, this foundational spiritual practices and traditions and stuff around the nature of reality itself, the truth that's its orientation, that's its function, the function of these practices, let's say, or approaches. When you take them into the secular field, it's about you'll be more intelligent, or you'll be more creative, or you'll be more, you know, peaceful or successful. And, you know, these are all very nice and everything, but this isn't.
Yeah, you'll sleep better.
Yes, you'll sleep better. Well, there's that great story, and I might as well repeat it. That when Maharishi Mahesh Yogi came over to the West, I think he came to Britain for a while. So I don't know if it was Britain or America. Anyway, he came over and did a few talks about his practice of transcendent, he called it transcendental deep meditation at the time, simple 20 minutes twice a day, simple practice. And, it took off and people were doing it. But there was a news story that was said, oh, look, Maharishi, look at this news story that came out. And it says, Indian guru finds cure for insomnia. Because what was happening was that people, some insomniacs were, you know, so wired that the moment they found this deep rest in meditation, that they had a nice night's sleep. And Maharishi for a moment went, oh, for God's sake, I came to wake people up and they're all going to sleep. And that was his, you know, sort of famous retort. But then, I guess then his answer to that was, actually, it's okay, because whatever reason you get into this kind of practice for, you're going to get all the benefits. So even if you go in there for a better tennis swing, you're going to get all the benefits of that that integration and the boundless nature becoming embodied and that kind of stuff. So it doesn't kind of matter what you get into it for. You're going to get all the benefits. So, you know, all right, if you want to meditate because you want to go to sleep, that's all right. yes. Shall we leave it there for today?
I think so. It feels like we've covered a lot of ground today.
We have. We generally do, though, I think.
Yeah.
Bounce around. But I'm glad we touched on silence
considerably. And bliss.
Because, you know, it's the, and bliss, which are indistinguishable. Yeah. So, yeah.
I think there's one thing I want to say, which is when you learn to fall in love with the silence, not as a goal or like I'm going to get something out of this,
yeah,
a transactional thing, but actually just allowing yourself to sink wholly into it and really savor this moment, not be looking for the next or whys or whats or all of that. This is where you start to taste the bliss of silence.
Yeah. It's not to get anywhere attain or achieve anything.
No, it's not. And so much of meditation can start out like that.
Yeah.
And to me, I want to say to someone, go deeper.
Yeah. Go deeper.
Go deeper. Leave these concepts and these ideas of what you're going to attain. Leave even the idea of enlightenment and awakening. Leave all of this behind and sink wholly into the silence of being. And it is there that you will discover the joy of that, the bliss of that.
And in time, that will just pervade your whole being and stay with you forevermore.
And every experience that comes will be from that ground, from the light of that.
In that light, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
Nice place to end today.
Great. Well, as usual, everyone, thanks for listening. If you like it, please like it. If you feel like you'd like to subscribe and not miss another episode, that's fine. And if you feel like you'd like to recommend or share it to someone, please do. It's all great. It all helps us to sort of put the word out.
Yeah. And reiterate what you say of like, we really appreciate everyone listening. It's, yeah. And all the feedback we get from people.
Yeah, and
is
if,
really
if anyone feels to, you know, ask questions or make comments or just generally, you know, reach out, then we very much welcome that.
Yeah. All right. Bye for now.
Okay. Bye for now.